I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a wide-ranging Friday literary conversation with author Steve Almond about his love of the late author Kurt Vonnegut and what it was like to be fodder for the right-wing radio gristmill. But first, more details on that September incident in Iraq involving Blackwater USA, with reports that at least one Blackwater security guard drew a weapon on another and that the incident involved three Blackwater teams. The incident left 11 Iraqis dead and prompted the past 2 weeks of debate over the role of private contractors in Iraq. Steve Fainarou of the Washington Post joins us. Steve, everyone seems to agree that the incident began when a Blackwater team was protecting an official who was visiting a ministry about a mile from the Green Zone. Then a car bomb went off, and that team began to remove that official and travel with him. What happened then, according to this State Department spot report that you've obtained?
Well, instead of staying inside the ministry after the car bomb went off, the Blackwater guards reported that it went off about 25 yards outside the entrance. They decided they were going to evacuate the official and return to the Green Zone. So they called in two other Blackwater teams, and one of those teams helped escort the other team and the official back to the Green Zone. The other team set up in a traffic circle about a mile away to protect the route. It was there that the incident occurred. The Iraqis, of course, say that the shooting was unprovoked. The people that we've spoken with in Baghdad have told us that the Blackwater guards entered the square and then began to set up a perimeter and stop traffic, and that there was a white sedan that was filled with a family that apparently did not slow down quickly enough, that the Blackwater guards fired on that sedan. The car burst into flames, killing the family inside. Essentially, bedlam broke loose, and there was shooting everywhere, and that a number of people were killed. The Blackwater guards said in the spot report that they came under fire from about 8 to 10 people who were dressed in civilian attire and Iraqi police uniform.
Well, you write that this is only an initial or spot report, but what does it say that is new?
That there were three Blackwater teams moving in that area, that the car bomb clearly did not precipitate the event in the sense that it triggered the shooting, but that was part of a sequence of events, that the U.S. military was called in to break up what was essentially an armed confrontation between Iraqi security forces and another Blackwater team that came to provide assistance to the one that was involved in the shooting.
The U.S. military pretty much rescued them.
The U.S. military came in and basically extracted them.
There's also an anecdote of a Blackwater guard pulling his weapon on other Blackwater guards and someone saying, "Stop the shooting."
Right. That's not in the spot report, but we're hearing that from other sources, that there may have been a confrontation within the Blackwater team that was involved in the shooting. As the shooting was going on, at least one of the Blackwater guards continued to shoot as his colleagues were urging him to stop, and that at least one Blackwater guard drew a weapon on at least one of his colleagues in an effort to get him to stop shooting.
Well, as we discussed on this program, Blackwater officials, any contractors for the U.S. military, have immunity in Iraq, and the Iraqi government was saying that they want that changed. Where does that stand?
Well, the Iraqis are saying that they're going to introduce their own law that would repeal Order 17, which granted that immunity. That's still ongoing. There is a clause, a little-known clause, within Order 17 that in which the sending state, in this case the United States, could waive that immunity if they felt it was necessary. And that theoretically would enable the Blackwater guards to be tried in Iraq. Now, whether that's going to happen, it's really unclear. I know Blackwater would fight that, you know, every step of the way.
Steve Fainarou of the Washington Post, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Writer Steve Almond is a longtime contributor to Here and Now as our literary reviewer, also a guest. His own books cover rock and roll, food. He's an expert on candy. His Candy Freak was a bestseller. He's also the guy who quit his job as adjunct professor at Boston College last spring in protest over the selection of Condoleezza Rice as commencement speaker. So, his interests are varied, his opinions strong and seriously left-leaning, And we want to spend a few minutes with him today because he's out with a new collection of essays. It's entitled Not That You Asked, Rants, Exploits, and Obsessions, in which he powerfully chronicles his deep devotion to writer Kurt Vonnegut, his fear of lobsters, and his stint as a self-described leftist demagogue descending Dante-like into the rings of media hell after his resignation from Boston College. And that's just a sample. And Steve joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm tired. That description just tired me out.
I know. It should. Well, a lot has happened. Let's start where you do at the beginning, because you write that Kurt Vonnegut, who just died a few months ago in April, is the guy who inspired you to write. What was the inspiration? What was it about Vonnegut?
Well, Vonnegut was the one guy who, if you're a, I think a lot of people who become writers are basically sad and lonely characters, figures. Mm-hmm. And you always want somebody to rescue you from that or assure you that you're not alone in those feelings of despair. And you want them to do it in a way that hopefully, in the best instance, actually makes you laugh, kind of step back from your own life and go, it's all absurd, and you got to rescue yourself. You got to forgive yourself from all this unhappiness and despair. And Vonnegut was that guy. He's that guy for, you know, I would say 50% of the young readers out there of my generation. He was the dude who was somehow able to convert that despair through his courageous imagination into uproariously funny novels that made you feel like there is somebody who gets all the BS in this world and isn't going to stand for it.
And amazing, considering he wrote, among other things, about being a prisoner of war in World War II, about witnessing the bombing of Dresden in Germany. Can you just, I mean, take yourself back just for a moment, the kapow moment.
The kapow moment was reading Slaughterhouse-Five and reading the introduction to Slaughterhouse-Five and going, oh my God, this guy is just telling me the truth. He confesses to the reader how much suffering writing this lousy little book, as he calls it, has cost him, that he spent 20 years. And he describes a scene in which he's sort of drunk at night, kind of drunk dialing, stinking of mustard gas and roses is the phrase. And I just thought, wow. Literature, and I don't think it was like a moment, because when you're 16, you're just so anxious, you're not thinking in big thoughts. But I remember having this bolt of feeling, oh, literature's the place where people just stop lying to you and tell you how really sad and humiliating and painful it is to be alive in a way that you somehow can bear.
So. Well, you become obsessed, I think is the right word, with
yes.
Vonnegut. Now you are a writer at this point in your story. And you go to hear him speak at a corporate event in Hartford, Connecticut. And this is a big fast forward. He's, at this point, an elderly man. What did you want from him?
What did I want? I wanted him to be my dad. Yeah. I wanted him to be my best friend. I wanted him to take me outside and smoke Pall Malls with me and say, son, it's going to be all right. That's the transference that every Vonnegut fan has.
And you'd written your thesis on him. At this point, you're telling yourself all you want is to interview him because you want to write a biography. That's what you're telling yourself.
Of course. It's total nonsense.
Well, tell us about one moment where you saw something that... It was quite powerful. It's after some audience members were asking him questions.
Yep. Well, the panel was really odd because Vonnegut was months away from his death and I think really quite heartbroken because he could see all around him all the ideas, basic ideas, be kind to the poor and the sick and, you know, be forgiving. That's what he's been preaching all his life. And suddenly you're living in this infantile world of SUVs and traffic and cheering for wars and, you know, rampant consumerism. So he was really heartbroken. And it was striking because this one high school girl named Mary asked him two great questions. The first question was, will you go to the prom with me? And the second question was, what's your philosophy of life? And so I guess I'll just read a little bit from that.
We should say at first, Vonnegut was grumpy and dismissive of the girl, the audience uncomfortable. This reading is after that.
Yeah, that's right. Right. I'm sort of waiting for him to rescue the moment. And the audience is too, you know, like 3,000 people. I thought of Vonnegut, a 21-year-old private, returning to Indianapolis to bury his mother after she took her own life, and his own imprisonment in Dresden just a few months later, all that ashen death, the passing of his sister, the madness of his son, his own suicide attempt in the haunted year of 1984. The camera was still fixed on Vonnegut's face, and it occurred to me with great clarity that he was going to die before he could say another word. He would simply and quietly sit back in his chair and perish. He was all done with the rescuing racket. Instead, he gathered himself and smiled at all the nice strangers before him and said, with an almost girlish lilt, "Of course I'll go to the prom with you, Mary, and I love to dance." And though nobody quite realized it, including Vonnegut himself, he had, with those two fine sentences, answered both her questions.
That second question, again, was, what is your philosophy of life? You conclude your essay writing that you realize that he essentially writes about family, and you do as well throughout your essays. You write about your communist grandparents who lived in fear, your dad who took a political stand and I think lost his job.
Mm-hmm.
And you write that a lesson that you got from your family is that you should suffer for your beliefs. That brings us
yes.
to another essay, your stand against Condoleezza Rice's commencement speaker. You explain in that essay that you hadn't really thought through your actions when you fired off a letter that became an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe. But, you know, I don't
Very wanna, true.
Yes, but were you really surprised at the venom from the right that you then received?
Yeah, I was completely surprised because a lot of people who are demagogues, I think, actually are idealists. They're crushed idealists. That is, they have some unreasonable expectation about the world that gets crushed, and then they become angry and aggrieved. Mine was...
Because you're calling yourself a demagogue.
Yes, I am. A very ineffective one, but, you know, like 2 on a scale of 1 to 100. But the point is that I was just disgusted. I was like, ick, why is BC the school I teach for, where I'm always telling my students, tell the truth, find the truth inside you, follow the good moral values of the basic Christian idea, love as a revolutionary force, intolerance for suffering of any kind, like, you know, the basic stuff in the New Testament. And here I had an administration for PR purposes to get the big money donors to give bucks back to the school, inviting Condoleezza Rice, who, whatever you think about her, she has just misrepresented the intelligence that got us into a horrible, disastrous war over which everybody's wringing their hands now. How can you say to students who I'm trying to teach, she's your moral exemplar?
And we're not going to re-debate. We had
yes.
you on this program when this
That's
happened,
right.
and we're not going to re-debate that. But, of course, at the time, you know, people said it's freedom of speech and you could have protested in other ways. You know.
Right.
But this was your strong passion
right.
Going into what became your media hell.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I expected that it would lead a charge and people would read that op-ed if it ran and they would say, yeah, we got to make this speech uncomfortable for her. We got to start to confront the members of the administration who have misled us into this disastrous war. We can't let them live in that bubble. I thought that's what was going to happen. I mean, again, naively, what happened was I got 800 email messages, 500 of which were, you are a commie, you know, you are the enemy of our troops and so forth. And only media outlets, yourself excepted, who really were interested in the story were right-wing demagogues, the Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity folks. They couldn't wait to talk to me. I got literally dozens of inquiries, all from the hatocracy, as I call them.
Well, and you also fell into a vat of hate of your own making, as you write. This is writer Steve Allman, out with a new collection of essays. He'll be back in a moment to tell us more about what he calls his demagogue days. Later in the program, the presidential political landscape 3 months ahead of the first showdown in Iowa. That's still to come. Back with more from Steve in just 1 minute, here and now. We're back with writer Steve Allman, whose new collection of essays is called Not That You Asked, Rants, Exploits, and Obsessions, his thoughts on Kurt Vonnegut, lobsters, parenting, and how he quit his job as adjunct professor at Boston College last year in protest over the selection of Condoleezza Rice as commencement speaker. That move placed Steve squarely in the sights of the right-wing media, and Steve writes that to his regret, he too descended into the modern inferno and joined them in demagoguery. Here he is being interviewed by Fox Television's Sean Hannity.
Did you vote for John Kerry?
What is it that you want to say to me? You're going to try to establish that I'm a lefty or a Democrat?
No,
I believe the public officials shouldn't
I already
lie.
Know you voted for John
Rice
Kerry, but you won't admit it.
Repeatedly.
But you don't have to. I'll tell you why.
Well, Steve, you were telling us how after your resignation you got hundreds of angry emails from conservatives, phone calls as well, from complete strangers, including a call from someone who said he was a professor. So pick up the story there.
So I get a few phone calls at home because my number's listed, and the right-wing blogs have all put my email address, and one of them has gone so far as to say a chat board, his phone number's listed. So people start calling. I got a few calls, and this one guy calls. He says originally he's a reporter for a newspaper. I say, where? He says, well, actually, I work at Villanova University. and I say, oh, you're a professor there. And he represents that he is, and then it's clear that he's not. He's just an angry guy calling from near Villanova who starts harassing me. You voted for John Kerry, didn't you? You're the problem. And he's incredibly angry. And so he just begins shouting, you're so pathetic. You're so effing pathetic, you liar. And I'll just read a little bit. Wait a second, I said quietly, why are you shouting at me? There was a brief silence. All right, he said, okay, I apologize. That wasn't cool. It was a weirdly poignant moment. I could hear the struggle in this guy's voice. He was trying so hard to swallow the venom that had prompted his call, trying to assimilate the notion that I was an actual human being. Really, I think it stunned him. And that dialing information and finding my number and actually calling me up and cursing at me, that this was really maybe, in a sense, a kind of sickness? What's going on here? I said. He took a deep breath as if to gather himself. Then he was roaring again. Nobody listens to a word you say. That's why, okay, you know that, a-hole? Nobody gives a F. Sorry, that's so profane. But, it is a weird thing to realize that our country is that angry that strangers can call you up and just start swearing at you, and you want to think, this isn't really about me. This has got to be about some kind of horrible self-loathing that's going on inside this person, because what I did was I made an act of conscience in a public way, but in the end, it didn't really have anything to do with, I don't have any personal beef. It has to do with Condoleezza Rice and my political disagreement. There should be a place in this country, if any, for civil discourse about moral differences.
You know, you labeled the right-wing talk show host that you became mincemeat for.
Yes. Thank you. That's the technical term, is mincemeat.
Yes. Did you ever think, as you were descending through these rings of hell, oh my gosh, I've become them?
Oh, I knew I was. I mean, I think in some sense that was the dream that I had, and I say this in the essay, that I would be the demagogue on the left, because I walk around like a lot of people on the left saying, where's the moral outrage from our side? Where's the demand? Vonnegut, this comes back to Vonnegut. Where's the demand that we be more decent to one another and be intolerant to suffering? Where is it in this country? Now is the time. Why are we knelling so silently in the mouth of death? I just haven't been unable to fathom it.
But I guess I'm asking, that's one thing, to have compassion, mm-hmm. but the other is to have hate. And, mm-hmm. you know, some of your writing, it's hate. So I'm just wondering, did you worry about, wait a second, for me to say I wish somebody dead, if I heard that come out of someone on the right. That would offend me.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I at least in the book, wish anybody dead. But look, I fully...
James Baker, at some point when you were a kid.
Oh, yes. Okay. All right. Guilty as charged, maybe. Yeah. I think what it is a kind of distress, and I think it's a kind of savagery that really, you talked about family before, it goes back to my family, being one of three brothers in a household that was very angry and didn't know what to do with those destructive impulses. And hey, in a family, that's for a family to take care of, but we're a country, and we have got to stop being led by mean children. It's time for the grown-ups, the people who can manage those feelings and recognize that they may feel outrage, but that they've got to act in a way that's in the interests of the state to step up.
In the end, were you sorry that you wrote the op-ed piece and quit and got into that media tangle? You write about meeting a kid that if you hadn't quit, you would have taught, and your last words are, I'm sorry about the whole damn shooting match.
Well, I'm sorry to lose the honor of teaching those kids. I mean, that's the thing. And to be, you know, a little, chew toy, basically, for Sean Hannity and the other frat boys on the right. I mean, that's basically what happened. I had the idea that I would sort of help to mobilize people on the left to be more politically active and take a stand, in a public stand, and say, no, this will not stand in our democracy. Our country is too great to allow Joseph McCarthy's descendants to mug the Constitution and our own humanity. And that didn't happen. And in the end, I thought, well, I learned a lesson about, hey, those are some tough bullies. But also I lost the honor of teaching those kids, because that was the thing. I would get calls about, oh, you know, you didn't even give up that much money. And it's like, dude, it's not about the money. I love my students. And I'm heartbroken when I hear from them and think, hopefully I'll teach again, but I don't get the honor of, I was supposed to teach two classes, and this kid came up to me and he's saying, well, I was supposed to be in your class next term, and I thought, man, maybe I really did screw this up.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, what are you going to do? Because, Robin, sometimes you have to say, you just have to act in a way that if you weren't sacrificing anything, what's the point of doing it?
Steve Almond, well, time has run out. We didn't even get to the part where you turned down Oprah's book club and then reconsidered and sent her your child.
She's being well cared for, I understand.
yes. Try to get in her good graces. Well, yes. For another time. Steve Almond's collection of essays is entitled Not That You Asked, Rants, Exploits, and Obsessions. Steve, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Next week on Here and Now, a terrific conversation. Space shuttle astronaut Sunny Williams. She just set the record for most time in space for a woman, and we spoke with her in front of a lot of adoring kids, as you'll hear. Also, John Spencer. He had already street cred with the punk and roots rock scene. Now he's assembled a new band called Heavy Trash to make sure rockabilly gets some respect. That's next week. Still ahead today, presidential politics. Back with the news Here and Now. The race for the White House is in full swing, with the first contests a little over 3 months away, with some primaries creeping ever closer. We've been dipping into the campaigns periodically, and we're going to do that again today. Last night's Republican debate on minority issues at Morgan State University in Baltimore attracted most of its attention because the top tier of candidates skipped it for fundraisers or speeches in other states. That drew the ire of one of the candidates who did show up last night, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee.
I'm embarrassed for our party, and I'm embarrassed for those who did not come, because there's long been a divide in this country, and it doesn't get better when we don't show up.
Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said it was an enormous error for his fellow Republicans to skip the debate. He called their scheduling excuses baloney. By the way, Gingrich said over the summer he'd test the waters for his own candidacy in late September. Look at the calendar. This weekend, his group, American Solutions for Winning the Future, is holding a convention in Atlanta. Stay tuned. In fact, we'll take the pulse of the Republican Party race next week. But first, a review of the Democrats back on the campaign trail after their latest debate earlier in the week in New Hampshire, where the candidates seemed to pull their punches. Then last night, Illinois Senator Barack Obama stepped squarely into Senator Hillary Clinton's ring.
I am glad to be in New York.
Well, joining us now to talk about the Democratic race, Steve Jarding, a Democratic consultant and author of Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Steve, welcome back.
It's always good to be on, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. And to Obama in New York last night, it's being called the largest turnout so far of the whole campaign, 20,000 people in Washington Square Park. But, you know, some say he and others pulled punches on Wednesday night when they could have gone after Hillary Clinton, the front runner. Was he saving those punches for when she wasn't there last night?
Well, in some ways, Robin, that's not a bad strategy. It's really difficult. I know a lot of the pundits were saying, you know, Hillary has opened this big lead. She's got a 22-point lead in a poll in New Hampshire now, and she's pulled even in Iowa, and she's, you know, on most of the number two ballots now, she's got a majority of the number two in Iowa, which is a big deal, and she's always pulled well nationally. So a lot of the pundits were saying, well, they've got to go after her. They really have to go after her in this debate. The problem with that, it sounds good, but it's hard to do, and I think all these guys, Barack Obama's a smart man, John Edwards is a smart man, they know from polling and other research that in primaries, if you get too nasty, if you go too negative, that very often you're the one that's hurt by it as much as the person you're pointing at. So it doesn't really surprise me they didn't do it in that forum, or as we saw, Robin, even when they did, you know, they might take a little punch and then they almost apologize for it, you know.
Well, I'm going to hear an example of what you're talking about. This is Delaware Senator Joe Biden talking about why Hillary Clinton failed in her bid to get universal health care passed when she was first lady.
I'm not suggesting it's Hillary's fault. I think it's a reality that it's more difficult because there's a lot of very good things that come with all the great things that President Clinton did. But there's also a lot of the old stuff that comes back. It's kind of hard. When I say old stuff, I'm referring to policy. Policy.
What a tightrope.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's actually a wonderful illustration of just how difficult it is, even for a guy like Biden that isn't a front runner. I mean, imagine if, you know, you're Obama or one of the front runners. You're Obama who's, you know, in a seemingly, although Hillary has opened up a bit of a lead, clearly has been fairly close to her for this whole campaign. Edwards, who's kind of been riding third, but kind of in the mix, certainly in Iowa he is, as is Obama. They're virtually tied there. But, you know, if it's it's easy for, or difficult rather, for Biden to do that. Imagine the front runners. It's a tough thing, and I do think, Robin, you're more likely to see the attacks when she's not standing next to them.
Well, here's Barack Obama that night talking about the same issue, Hillary Clinton's failure on universal health care.
The issue is not going to be who has these particular plans. It has to do with who can inspire and mobilize the American people to get it done and open up the process. If it was lonely for Hillary, part of the reason it was lonely, Hillary, was because you closed the door to a lot of potential allies in that process. At that time, 80% of Americans already wanted universal health care, but they didn't feel like they were let into the process.
So a little tougher there, but I want to ask you, some analysts before the debate were saying that the party had already started asking other candidates not to beat up too much on the perceived frontrunner, Hillary Clinton, because that would only come back to haunt them down the road if Republicans, for instance, use their words. Is this, you know, is the party sending the signal it's over?
I don't know that you're sending a signal that it's over. I think they're smart. And history is replete with examples. I mean, the one that is probably most telling, not that George McGovern would have won in 1972, but people forget he ended up debating Hubert Humphrey, didn't want to debate Humphrey. Humphrey just tore him apart. I mean, not necessarily to win the debate, but just threw a bunch of stuff at him, and Nixon turned around and used that as a gold mine to take on McGovern. I think the party remembers things like that, and they're looking and saying, no, you know, guys, get in here and talk about the issues, but do not hand the Republicans an issue. Do not hand them a clip that where they can say, look at the, you know, Hillary's own party or Obama's own party. This is what they were saying about her. Don't do that, because it's going to be a tight race. We cannot afford. There's very little margin for error here. So let's be civil. Let's do this right. And I, you know, frankly, I don't blame them. You and I can kind of sit back as people that analyze this and watch it, and it's, you know, it's part of what we do for a living, and you say, boy, I wish I'd mix it up a bit. But it's hard, you know, for me to go after the party and say, are you sending a signal, or, you know, people might misconstrue this that you think it's over. I don't believe that's what they're doing. I think they're saying that we know from every indicator this public is so polarized. They were in 2000, they were in 2004. Every indicator says they're going to be split right down the middle again. Do not give that 0.5%, 1% margin of error by going after each other and giving these guys issues to the poll.
What about Iraq? Clinton, Obama, and John Edwards all have advocated a timetable for withdrawal, but they refused to promise to have the troops out by January 2013. Now, you listen to a lot of right-wing radio, they have seized on that. You know, 2013, that's certainly not what the Corps wanted when the Corps voted Democrats into Congress months ago.
Well, that's right, and if I'm talk radio and on the conservative side, I'd be talking about that too, because I think the conservatives want the Democrats to pick a time certain. The American public has not necessarily indicated they want time certain; they just want it done. I think what you're seeing is all these front runners, particularly again Hillary, Obama, Edwards. They're not going to fall into a general election trap. That is, they're not going to say something now that's going to hurt them in the fall. And so it was interesting to watch it, but I don't think it was surprising. These guys are not going to go say and do anything right now, particularly when all three of them are tied to Iowa, that somehow is going to hurt them in the fall. They have to have that eye toward the fall, and I think that's what they were doing, and frankly, it's not a bad strategy.
Just a couple seconds here. I want to ask you, John Edwards said yesterday he's going to accept public campaign financing. He called it a principled decision, saying the system is corrupt, but is he just admitting he can't raise the money that Clinton and Obama can?
Well, I think that's, you know, listen, I'm not impugning John Edwards. If he says that he's doing that because the system's broken, the system is broken. He's right about that. But normally, and we'll see in a couple days when the third quarter numbers come out, the first thing I thought of when I saw it was, oh, my gosh, his numbers must be awful. And I don't mean to be cynical, but that's usually the way it works. And you could bet if he's raising as much as Hillary and Obama, and that indeed is more than the public financing, that he wouldn't take it. So
Steve,
I think that's a pretty good indicator.
Steve Jarding, Democratic consultant, author of the book Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. The title is so long. Steve, thanks so much as always.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Good to talk to you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Ah, Fall began this week. Can the fall classic be far behind? Major League Baseball ends its regular season this weekend. We're starting to get World Series fever, though the American League is pretty much set. The National League way up in the air. Here to help us sort the action out, talk about the rest of the news from the world of sport. Is there any? Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only Game. Phil, nice as always to see you.
That's good to be here.
Yeah, and let's start with the National League. A lot to keep track of this weekend, possibly even into Monday, because all three divisions and the wild card are still up in the air. Seven teams still alive for the four spots. So parse it out for us.
Well, the Mets seem to be determined to let the Phillies back into the postseason. Very curious development. And last night, both the Cubs and the Brewers lost. So obviously neither of those teams much wants to play in October.
Right.
It's a very curious situation. You have some teams that are very hot and some that are going the opposite direction. And nobody quite knows where on the graph they will intersect yet.
Right, because you also have in the West the Arizona Diamondbacks have a one-game lead over the San Diego Padres and a two-game lead over the Colorado Rockies. That's a three-team race there. You mentioned in the East the New York Mets and the Philadelphia Phillies. Mets lost 10 of the last 14. Phillies won 11 of the last 14.
Kind of a Boston ring to that Mets thing going on there, isn't there? Nobody can explain these things. Excuse me, Robin. I think one thing that may be puzzling fans in some of these places, especially someplace like Colorado, is their team is playing so well. What took you so long?
Yeah.
You know, you obviously have the horses.
Right.
Why'd you wait until the fall?
I was going to go with the horses thing, saddles or something. I don't know.
Something will occur to you about 3 o'clock tomorrow morning.
I know. The American League postseason, four teams, the Los Angeles Angels, the Cleveland Indians, the Yankees, and the Red Sox, are going to be playing. The only question is, who gets the division title in the East, the Yankees or the Red Sox?
Mm-hmm.
And the Red Sox, have decided to leave, was it last night, 103 guys they left on base?
Something like that. It was very similar to the 12,000-game lead they had over the Yankees earlier this summer. Somewhere in that neighborhood.
That they've blown. But, so the Red Sox have managed to blow that lead. But what about the Yankees coming back?
Well, my friend Tim Kirkchin, with whom I frequently speak on Only a Game on Saturday morning, has a pet phrase. He always says, "The Yankees are still the Yankees, Bill." And they are.
What does that mean?
It means they've been in the playoffs for the last 78 years, and they don't always win the World Series, but they always seem to be there when the money is on the table. And they're going to be there again, and nobody who's watched them play since the All-Star break should bet against them.
Yeah. Okay, I have to say, one of my favorite moments this week at work was I burst into one of the studios we had to work in, and there was a clutch of guys, all guys, hiding in the darkened studio, huddled, cutting work, playing truant, huddled around a TV set, watching the women's soccer. Oh, tough. Women's soccer, the Women's World Cup. This Sunday, the U.S. women are going to be playing for a medal, but it's not the one they're hoping for. They'll be meeting Norway for third place because they lost to Brazil in that game you were watching.
They did, and the loss was worse than the score indicated in this case. They lost 4-0, which is a romp, of course, in soccer terms, but the game wasn't that close. Brazil outplayed them in every aspect of the game, and Brazil also had luck on its side and at least one curious call by an official. But even without the luck and the curious call by the official, Brazil would have won that game. They were the better team.
Yeah, I mean, the women who hadn't been getting that much attention, they lost to the U.S. recently, a while back, and so they were just sort of shunted aside. They did fantastically.
Well, they've done what teams have to do in the World Cup, and that is play a little bit better in each game. And I thought that the game against the U.S. was by far their strongest performance. And, of course, everybody is talking about Marta, their magnificent striker, who may be the very best female soccer player in the world. And the people who've watched the replay of her second goal in that game against the U.S. have stopped saying it's the greatest goal ever in Women's World Cup and have begun to say it may be the greatest goal ever in the World Cup.
go online, check it out. So Brazil meeting Germany for the gold on Sunday. And just real quick, Bill, so professional hockey starts this season this weekend. Where else but in London?
Where else but in London? Now, what will people in the good old city make of the grand old regional game that they play in some parts of the United States?
The Anaheim Ducks are going to be playing there in London, England. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Coming up, Janapalooza, all Jane Austen all the time, here and now.
I'm
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On a picture-perfect late summer afternoon, about 100 members and friends of the Jane Austen Society of Massachusetts gathered at a conference center outside of Boston.
Oh, I just realized we need to pull the blinds and turn off the lights so we can see the slides a little better.
After a lecture highlighting the similarities between Austen's writings and paintings by Vermeer, a high tea begins, followed by line dancing. Men in breeches and waistcoats promenade women in flowing empire dresses across the floor of a hall with vaulted ceilings, a sweeping staircase, and a balcony. Marcia Huff, president of the Jane Austen Society of America, says there's a reason Austen fans are celebrating. She is a literary icon now, mentioned in the same breath as Shakespeare. Jane Austen, says Huff, has arrived.
Arrived in the sense that she's almost a household name now. She's just everywhere.
In fact, it's Janeapalooza. In theaters now, the Jane Austen Book Club, a film about a group of modern-day Californians who read an Austen novel a month until gradually their lives parallel her stories. Earlier this month, Anne Hathaway starred in Becoming Jane, very loosely based on Austen's love life. Meanwhile, Masterpiece Theater is preparing a four-month-long Austen Fest featuring productions of all of her novels. Two musicals are in development, and there's a slew of Austen-related books, including Austen Land, about a fictitious theme park, and Confessions of a Jane Austen Addict. There's a Jane Austen action figure. It comes with a desk and a quill pen, and a Jane Austen board game. You guessed it, the first to marry wins. It's all Austen all the time, and it pretty much all began in 1996 with a BBC film adaptation of her most popular novel, Pride and Prejudice.
Could you expect me to rejoice in the inferiority of your connections? To congratulate myself on the hope of relations whose condition in life is so decidedly below my own?
You're mistaken, Mr. Darcy. The mode of your declaration merely spared me any concern I might have felt in refusing you had you behaved in a more gentlemanlike manner. You could not have made me the offer of your hand in any possible way that would have tempted me to accept it.
The roller coaster romance of Elizabeth Bennet and Fitzwilliam Darcy vaulted Pride and Prejudice and Austen into the pop culture. Hollywood hopped on the bandwagon with a star-studded remake. There were also updates. Clueless was a take on Emma. And a Bollywood version, Bride and Prejudice.
We must make sure Jaya meets this Mr. Balraj from London before anyone else.
All mothers think that any single guy with big bucks must be shopping for a wife.
I'm embarrassed to say, but I hope he is.
What, shopping or loaded?
Well, both.
While Austen's writing is marked by elaborate character development and her dialogue exquisitely nuanced, her plot lines follow a simple path. Not quite rich enough young women struggling to find a suitable, perhaps wealthy, mate within the confines of a rigid system of class and manners. Huff and fellow Janeite Marcia McClintock Folsom say Austen's themes are timeless and universal.
I do think it's the appeal, partly, of watching a person grow through mistakes and through social contact and through thinking that draws contemporary women to think about their own lives as reflecting the kinds of growth that takes place in Austen novels.
Like Lizzie Bennet trying to decide whether Wickham is false or Darcy is true, how she feels, trying to overcome her prejudice. They're actions and character traits that almost anyone can identify with at some phase in their life, and maybe all through their life in different ways.
And the famous line at the end of the scene when she finally realizes how grossly she's been mistaken is, "Till this moment, I never knew myself." It's discovery of the self's participation in error that frees her. I think people find that exhilarating.
Jenny Kelly and Jesse Ellis agree. They're two recent college grads who came dressed for the occasion.
I made a Regency-era Empire waist dress and decided to wear it to this occasion because I thought it would be appropriate and I never get the chance to wear it. Yes, looks very nice.
Jenny and Jesse say even though Austen wrote more than 200 years ago and her characters have fewer options available than women today, they still see some lessons in Austen.
we'll always have the same sorts of issues to deal with in terms of, like, courtship. It may be different, but it always affects every woman to, you know, find a husband, and women's roles are changing and they're different today, but it's still there.
The standards are different. The basics are still the same.
What's not the same is the sex. In this post-Sex and the City world, Austin seems tame. There's plenty of cleavage, but never consummation. For today's audience, her characters are studies in polite repression. One Austin fan calls it non-pornographic porn, the type that takes place only between the ears. Is that enough for today's 20-somethings like Jenny and Jesse?
Yes. Yes. Very big. Yes.
Her themes are especially sparkling and entertaining for someone who's younger, who's going through the very turmoil, the very decisions that her main characters are going through.
That's Marcia Huff again from the Jane Austen Society of America. She also admits that Austen's copyright-free books make them cheap fodder for film adaptations, but she says the lush English countryside and period settings are what lure filmmakers in.
The costumes were gorgeous, and they're very sensuous. They always show the figure very beautifully, so that you add the physical element, which is what a movie's all about, the visual element, to the plots, which are about young people falling in love, and you've got an absolutely perfect formula. It's boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. Any way you want to formulate it, it's going to be popular.
So popular that People magazine says we are living in a Jane Austen moment. But for many men, dragged off by friends and wives to the latest Austen chick flick, that moment can feel like a very long slog.
I was expecting sort of a drivelly romance. I was prepared to be kind of bored and nauseated, and nothing of the sort. I found myself laughing out loud.
Ben Wehe is in his early 30s. He says he willingly gave up a football Sunday to attend this event. He calls his introduction to Austen eye-popping.
Every moment, some of the female characters are latching on to their, this male will fulfill my fantasy, and then manipulating the world to equal that, either in trying to ensnare him or get his attention. And then, you know, something happens and, oh, complete switch. No, he's not. So that, yeah, I think there's something to that that probably does happen still today. And that's not really something that men go through in quite the same way, I think.
But who are we kidding? Austen holds more sway for women, women like Marion Redman, who says she knows people in her own life who are similar to Austen's characters, and that makes her feel kind of close to the author.
I've read so much about Jane Austen as a person, I feel like I know her. I feel like she's a friend or something. It's very strange. But,
strange, like an obsession?
You know, I do have these phases that I go through, definitely, that I have to read something right away, or something triggered something, that I have to go home and watch one of my movies, or so. I know it sounds strange. Oh, my boyfriend thinks I'm crazy sometimes, but no, I wouldn't say obsessed. It's just a fun passion.
A passion that's likely to engulf more and more women, and perhaps a man or two, before the current love affair with Jane Austen is over.
You should say something about the dance, perhaps. I might remark on the number of couples.
You talk by rule, then, when you're dancing?
Yes, sometimes it is best. Then we may enjoy the advantage of saying as little as possible.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.